Hello and welcome into the KE Report. I'm your host, Shad Markowitz, and I'm speaking today with Eric Wetterling, a.k.a. the Hedgeless Horseman. Eric is well known on many investing forums like CEO.ca and has his own website, thehedgelesshorseman.com. Eric, it's always great having you on the show just to get your thoughts on how you're approaching investing in the resource sector, and in particular, the gold and silver mining stocks. So I guess I want to kick things off today with just, what is your general approach in these roller coaster markets? I know that you generally don't get too bent out of shape or too excited about price moves, because when you're looking at companies, you're trying to value it for the project and for the overall asset and what the risk reward setup is. So why don't you just peel back the layers on what does Eric do when he's investing in resource stocks as a value investor?
I mean, first of all, it's like, what is the only thing that an investor can control at the end of the day? That's price. That's the only thing we can control, the price we're paying for something. We don't know what the future is going to be. We don't know the short, medium, or long term. But we can skew odds in our favor. It's like, I have no idea what any stock will do tomorrow. I don't have any idea what a given stock will do a week from now or a month from now. But if you look, for example, on, you know, Twitter and most forums, etc., and, you know, the questions I get, most questions are, what do you think stock X is going to do in the short term? So it's like, it's abundantly clear most people are short-term traders. And my simple strategy, which I deployed from day one, that's, I mean, the whole reason why I got into the junior sector, because it looked so cheap in 2015. So my simple strategy has always been estimate, I mean, in a broad sense, then you can add a bunch of, you know, you can throw in some TA, you can throw in some, like, what would turn the sentiment, for example. But to just drag it down to the lowest denominator, let's say, it's just that, okay, I want to buy something that I think is right now preferably worth a lot more than I'm paying for it, and will be worth more going forward. Because again, it's like, I have no idea what's going to happen in the short term. But there are for sure a bunch of projects where I can visualize a base case of what will have happened within 6, 12, 18, 24 months. It's like, there's a bunch of exploration plays out there where I have no idea what the next news release is going to show. I have no idea how the market is going to react to it. So it's like, again, you're guessing something, you know, twice over. It's like, okay, what would the news release say, and how is the market going to react? That's what you're faced with if you're a catalyst hunter, basically a trader. I don't like to play that game because I think it's, you know, one of the hardest games to play. I do, however, like to sometimes ride the drill hype, for example, without taking the actual as a risk, let's say, because in that case, if it goes up on real hype, I can sell it before I have to even think about what the actual news release is going to be, or then also what the actual reaction is going to be. But if I have a base case for a solid base case for 12 to 24 months, let's say, where I think there's a high probability of the company that is already undervalued today, there's a high probability of it being even more undervalued in 12 months and 24 months, where when they have will have drilled, let's say, you know, 50 holes or whatever. So in that case, that's a game I like to play, because again, the pricing in the market is based on the short term. So I'm, in my opinion, just, you know, using, let's say, time arbitrage or patience arbitrage, I'm buying what I think company X is going to be on balance worth in 12 months and looking at what the price is for that future today. And I think there's that's where your simplest and biggest edge is, because nobody is pricing in the companies 12 months from now today.
Well, the markets are forward-looking, but I hear what you're saying. When you look at development projects, when you look at just the size of certain companies' ounces in the ground and what that's worth, the metal value in situ in the ground and where they're actually trading. And sometimes when you look at people's marketable securities or the cash that they have in their balance sheet or just their all their other secondary and tertiary projects, when you look at all those, sometimes they're getting no value for any of that. So I see what you're saying about being a value investor and not worrying about the short-term blips, but looking at, you know, a one-year to two-year time horizon. What should the project and what should the company be worth? Another factor we talked about off mic before we started recording is the concept of what everybody's looking for, Eric. They're looking for that 10-bagger. And you brought up a great point about how long it would take to get a 10-bagger in traditional markets and how skewed people's thinking is as far as how long they have to wait to get a 10-bagger. So I'd love you to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I'm fighting with myself. I mean, I find it kind of ironic that what most people are after in this business is the allure of a 10-bagger. Okay, but how do you actually get a 10-bagger? There's typically not a 10-bagger that's going to, you know, materialize if you don't hold a certain stock for at least 1, 2, maybe 3, maybe 4 years. It will be worth it, first of all, because, you know, if you have 900% return in you know, within 5 years, for example, that's well worth it. So I find it, again, ironic that me included have a tendency to be short-term orientated, because we're human nature, we want instant gratification. But so everyone is basically actively working in the opposite direction of their stated goal. Because again, how to get a 10-bagger is to sit on your hands, do nothing, and ride a stock as it grows over multiple years. But most people are trying to guess what stock X is going to do tomorrow or next week or in a month. And at the same time, when you think about it, it's like, okay, in terms of patience, I know some people are complaining, you know, my portfolio is down a year. Okay, sure. But I mean, there's been two and a half years corrections. I've been a part of those as well. And I think it was from the top in 2017, for example, even longer correction. What happened as the juniors bottom went up several hundred percent? So it's like, if you just buy low, how do you typically buy low? Being a value investor is the easiest way, because then you get the sentiment aspect for free, because sentiment is going to be poor when everything is cheap. So you automatically become a contrarian of sorts without even actively looking to be a contrarian. Then you just have to wait. I mean, most of the juniors out there are at absolutely ridiculous price levels. At the next sentiment high, which will come, absolute 100% will come, you're going to see the average junior up several hundred percent, and then you just have to, you know, have a bigger perspective and think that, okay, how long, given that the market, the broader stock market averages around 8-9% per year, how long should you be willing to wait to have a, let's say, 200% return? That's many years. And people are complaining that it hasn't appeared in the last 1-2 years, let's say. So it's like, when you think about it, it's, you can wait a long time, still be right. But the thing is also, you have to be on board the train, let's say. Because what I typically tended to do sometimes is I sold a story way too early. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea to hang on for a almost 2-year correction, then wait for 50%, you know, upside, let's say, and then, you know, call it quits, because then you miss the actual, you know, big move that's supposed to offset the pain that you just experienced. So I don't know. I think it's just one of those things that makes, I mean, that's obviously the hardest part about this market. But when you really think about it, if you're really truly rational about it, A, juniors are so cheap right now, and we know how expensive they can get. So there's like, just sentiment arbitrage alone is going to have a lot of juniors up 200%. Okay, how long would you be able to wait for that? A long time. Then you have the growth stories on top of that, that probably going to add value. So they'll probably, you know, some will go up instead of 200%, they'll go up 300-400% if you give them enough time. And yeah, I'm just circling back to the fact that patience, common sense are, I think, the most important things for an investor. And it's also the hardest things to put into practice, because we're constantly bombarded with short-term thinking, the next hot pick. And I have a problem myself not looking at the portfolio. I know I'm not going to even do anything, so it's totally meaningless. who cares if Junior is up 5%? I mean, I'm after the 200% return. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of the time, the stuff we do makes absolutely zero sense when you think about it, but it's so damn hard not to be human.
Well, there's one other area where people could push back on this thesis of value investing, and that is opportunity cost. So there are some investors that would say, hey, Eric, you know, if you sit in a stock for a year or two and you're eventually right, yeah, that's a big payoff, but why not wait till later to get into it? Why sit in a stock that's perpetually going down for a year or two? Because most people don't have the stomach for that. So what would you say to that comment that like that there's an opportunity cost to sitting in a stock that's gradually trending down when you could be in something that's going up, a different sector maybe?
That's a very good question. I think opportunity cost is the most misused term I see out there. Because, okay, what is opportunity cost? I mean, when is the opportunity? It is at any given moment. So if you're a value investor, let's say, and you think of a screw word, what am I paying? What am I buying? So it's like, in hindsight, there's a whole trough full of people who comes out and say, well, the opportunity cost in that stock has been yada, yada, yada. But it's like, okay, there are going to be people who argue that there's been opportunity cost for owning miners versus owning Tesla. But it's like, is that truly opportunity cost that, let's say you bought a company, Tesla, let's say traded for 60 PE and it was already overvalued. It went up to 500 PE. Versus your junior that was trading at a PE equivalent of like 6, it went down to 3 during the same period. Is that an opportunity cost? I would say that it's clearly in the extremely cheap junior and getting increasingly better. So actually the opportunity cost, I would say, is actually increasing for Tesla. So it's a big difference between opportunity at any given point, because then you don't know the future. Versus just looking, let's say, back and say, well, this expensive stock became even more expensive. So it's like obvious opportunity. No, that's not how I work. I want to have the risk reward on my side. I don't want to chase something because, with that kind of thinking, everything had an opportunity cost against Dogecoin. But it was Dogecoin really an opportunity to begin with? I mean, in my opinion, it's, you know, worthless. And it's been a greater full trading sardine, basically. So again, it's like, if one understands what actually an opportunity is, especially if you come from the standpoint of value investing, just because something is hot and is already expensive and is probably going to get more expensive, is that a better opportunity than buying something that is cheap that you know will someday go up, again, versus chasing something that's already overvalued and you know will come down? So I don't buy that at all. I think many people misuse that and they try to, I don't know. I personally think that the people that use the word opportunity cost the most, I actually don't think they have as great results as they portray to be, or they might be taking huge amounts of risk, because obviously there's going to be a million crypto hodlers that are going to beat your mining portfolio over the last 2-3 years. But are they great investors? Can you redo that, let's say? Is that a strategy that works? I would say that this cryptomania, for example, which, you know, everyone is, you know, let's say, hotspot for people talking about opportunity cost, I think they're just, one day that's going to go crashing down and they're one trick ponies, because when they can't ride this mania in the greater fool trading sardines anymore, they're stuck with having no plan, no strategy, etc. I think it's a lot better to actually learn investing, appreciate what an opportunity is. It's not hindsight investing. It's the best risk reward you can pick right now. And if I have to choose between a hot stock that might get more overvalued than a stock that is very cheap and has a disgusting downtrend, I will pick the disgusting downtrend any day, because then I at least know I'm not making a mistake from a value investor's perspective.
The disgusting downtrend is so attractive. No, I hear what you're saying, Eric, and there's very few people that look at it that way, and that's why I wanted you to unpack that thought. And I wanted to talk about opportunity cost because we hear that so much, people throw that around so much, but really opportunity cost is that you could have made money somewhere else, but those are momentum traders, not value investors. Those are trend followers, not value investors. So there is a difference in the strategies, and people should know themselves and know what strategy they're deploying. You know, based on that, let's give somebody an example of a value investment where you think being patient is going to be worth the candle because of all the implied value. Can you think of a company that would be a good example for that?
Yeah, I recently put out an article describing my case for Nevada King Gold, ticker NKG.V. And I think that's one of the most undervalued stories out there. And like you alluded to earlier, in this market, you don't get anything for your peripheral assets. I mean, most single asset units are cheap based on their single asset. And if you have multiple assets, you're probably undervalued based on your flagship asset, and everything else comes for free. So, I mean, in my opinion, it's like Nevada King is one of the most no-brainer cases from a risk-reward and value investing standpoint. I think their market cap is around 95 million Canadian. They have the Atlanta gold mine, which is basically it already has a historic resource. And they've actually found out now that there's a very high-grade zone that's running along a fault that's immediately below the historic open pit. So basically, that was a game-changer for Atlanta, and therefore, given the valuation of Nevada, I think it's a game-changer for the company. So it's like, in my opinion, I think the Atlanta gold mine alone is going to prove to be worth more than the market cap of Nevada King. I mean, especially if you factor in where gold is trading. I mean, it just becomes silly because most juniors out there are like trading for 10% of their NPV or whatever. So it's not a shocker that it might, you know, be really undervalued based on the gold they already have. But I think that's a probable grower. It's in Nevada, tier one jurisdiction, obviously. I mean, site of a, you know, historic mine, et cetera. So I'm assuming, you know, permitting shouldn't be that hard because it's disturbed ground. And there's probably, you know, pods and zones beyond that just within the Atlanta gold mine district. But then you get like, I think it's 11 projects or so in addition to that, which I don't think you're paying at all for, really. And they're drilling two of them, or have really loose projects. They're drilling Iron Point right now. And Iron Point is a monster target. I mean, it has one of the most impressive geochem anomalies in Nevada. So the interesting part about that from a risk-reward perspective is that, okay, if you think that Nevada King is already cheap based on Atlanta Gold Mine, and especially including all the other projects outside of Iron Point, then you're basically getting any upside at Iron Point for free. So, I mean, if they drill 100% dusters, I don't think Nevada King is cheap. If they hit, it would become perhaps a lot cheaper all of a sudden. So that's the kind of risk reward I really like. It's like, you know, buying lottery tickets you're not paying for. Whereas if you buy a single asset junior with a single target, that's the only ticket they have. If they fail to hit something at that single project, I mean, the story is, for all intents and purposes, kind of dead. Unless, you know, it's a great management team and they can, you know, pick up another project, whatever. So I think, again, the risk reward in Nevada King is great because you get the margin of safety through Atlanta. I think you get probable upside through Atlanta. You get a bunch of value for free in all the other projects. I mean, in a hot market environment, they could split up the company like 3-4 times. And I can pretty much guarantee that the combined market caps of these 3-4 entities will be a lot higher than the market cap right now, given its prime ground in the Battle Mountain Eureka trend, or a Cortez trend. So I think, in my opinion, risk reward no-brainer. Is it the most exciting stock? Maybe not for some people, but if one factors in, you know, possible future scenarios and the risk you're taking for said future scenarios, I think it's, again, one of the best value place right now, and that's why I have it as a kind of cornerstone holding in some family portfolios, where basically I like to put in cases that are, again, long term, where I don't need to trade at all, and it's like I know I'm underpaying for it right now, and in my opinion, it's, you know, the risks are for sure to the upside, whereas I don't want to have a bunch of companies I need to trade, or I'm, you know, the next catalyst or the next drill results can kill the stock or whatever. This is nothing like that. I'm again biased. I mean, I own shares. You know, family members own shares, and they're a sponsor. But I would, if that sounds interesting, I think you should at least take a look at the case and form your own opinion, because I would love to hear a better case for it.
Okay, Eric, I think that's a good example of a value investing a company where there's a lot of unrealized opportunity still in the stock that the market is not pricing in. I guess just as we wrap up, I always like to get your thoughts on any miners you think are doing good work or that you think maybe are flying under the radar, or maybe they are disgustingly cheap right now. Is there any companies that come to mind that you'd like to mention to people here at the KE Report?
Yeah, well, there's, in my opinion, quite a unique exploration story in the form of Goliath Resources. And just to make it clear, it's an exploration story. They don't have banked resource or anything like that. So it's not, you know, go all in or anything like that, or buy it for your grandma or whatever. But let me just explain why I think it's so unique. First of all, they had one drill campaign over at the Shorebet Zone in 2021. They put in 24 holes. They had 100% hit rate. They hit mineralization in every hole, and that included a 1 kilometer step out hole down dip. That's incredible, you know, from the get-go. It's like, how many systems do you have 100% hit rate on your first drill campaign? I don't think I know a single one, unless they were drilling the same spot. So first of all, the 1 kilometer step out hole is like massive, obviously, because if you do a fan drilling, you could have, you know, hit a pocket or whatever that might not actually be that large, but to do a blind hole 1 kilometer down and also hit, I mean, that just boosts up the risking factor, in my opinion. It just shows how, you know, there's a good chance that this is a homogeneous system where it's actually, you know, hey, this might actually have this kind of predictable mineralization. And this drill campaign, this year's drill campaign, they just raised 13 million, I think. Which I think goes to show how much, you know, institutions, smart money, etc., is looking at this one, because they're not buying in the open market. You see that typically show up in the private placements, let's say, where they can actually take substantial positions. So anyway, great metallurgy, 100% hit rate so far. The target they will be drilling is a huge one, and they actually found what's called the extension target, and they will actually drill a third target that was they came up with that today with an updated drill plan. They will have some of the most aggressive step out holes. I think they're going to be stepping the farthest step out hole will be like 2 kilometers. So in my opinion, this is one of the most predictable systems I've seen. It's high grade, what we know of, average grade 6.3 AU equivalent, I think. Average width is like 5.6 meter, I think. So okay, it looks to be thick, high grade, very predictable, homogeneous, great metallurgy in BC, underground, so it's ESG friendly, and BC is obviously one of the hardest jurisdictions out there. So it's like they could theoretically go from having, I mean, I guess you could infer something based on, you know, the fan ring right now, but they could do a real quantum leap, because if you put some numbers on that target, that's a, you know, not to get too overboard, but I think they could, one could infer that they have like 3 to 5 or maybe more million ounce potential just from the coming drill campaign. So theoretically, and I'm not talking about, you know, immediately and necessarily a banked resource, but I think this junior is one that can do the highest quantum leap in one drill season that I might be aware of. And I just think that's absolutely fascinating, because if there's a system one would allow oneself to speculate in terms of projecting banked success forward, I think it should be a system that's had 100% hit rate so far. So I'm super excited about that one. And again, they could go from having no ounces to like inferred multi-million ounces in just one drill campaign. But again, it's absolutely not 100% guarantee, far from it, but it's like, yes, there's a great possibility, and I don't know if I know a single junior that could do that quantum leaps. And with that, I would also add that I think there's a chance to do perhaps the drill hype trade basically, because I think more and more people will get aware of just how material this coming drill season, and that might be one of the, you know, absolutely hardest drill place in the entire space. And I think the closer we get to drilling, and especially assays, I think that can garner quite a bit of attention from the hot money, because this is one of few stories that actually could theoretically jump in intrinsic value by hundreds of percent from, you know, a few news releases. And you don't see that typically. I mean, most companies put out a discovery hole or whatever, and then they're off to, you know, wait for next season or a few holes more, and then the season is over, or they need to, you know, do some more work before they look, okay, we had one good hit here. They've hit on all holes. This is incredible. I'm super biased. I own a lot of shares. They're a sponsor. But when you think about it, it is actually quite a unique drill spec play.
Well, Eric, thanks for covering that. Again, that's Goliath Resources, GOT on the TSXV. And in the U.S., the ticker is GOTRF on the OTC. We're going to wrap it up there. That's a lot of information for people to mull over, but I appreciate you outlining again how you approach value investing, how you approach things with patience for the longer-term prize based on how you value these companies, and thanks for sharing that outlook on why you're excited about Goliath Resources. Eric, it's always great having you on the show. If people like getting Eric's thoughts, definitely check out his website, theheadlesshorseman.com. There's a link to that down below. And Eric, have a great rest of the week.
The same. Thanks, Joe.